I'm here in Ballinalak and I'm talking to Stephen Gault. Stephen, your surname would indicate that it comes from Scotland, is that right?
That's correct. My father's father originated from a wee village in Scotland called Paisley, and he moved over during before the war, I think it was, and then got married to a girl from just outside Ballymena, who was my granny. And that's where the Gault family, there is Gaults in Fermanagh, but no other Gaults are a relation, except I have a brother that lives just a couple of miles from me, but we're the only Gaults from our side of the family.
Okay, and coming from Presbyterian?
My father would have been Presbyterian, my mother was Church of Ireland, but when they got married, my father then made the jump from church to, he became a Church of Ireland parishioner then.
And so what was your father's first name?
My father's name was Samuel Gault, and he was in the RUC.
And was he full-time in the RUC?
Yes, he had served 28 and a half years in the RUC, but unfortunately he took a heart attack when he was 46, and he took early retirement when he was 47 and a half, 48.
Mm-hmm. From the RUC. And so was he positioned down here? How did he get to how did he get to Enniskillen then?
It came about when he left Larne. He was originally from Larne. He left Larne when he was 18, 19 years of age, and he joined the RUC. And then Enniskillen then was the training centre for the RUC. And obviously a new recruit, he met my mum, who was originally from Enniskillen, fell in love and got married. And when they got married, they moved to Forkill in South Armagh, and that's where Dad would have been stationed in his first few years in the RUC. And in 12th of November, Remembrance Sunday 1961, Dad was part of a 6-man police patrol in Jonesboro, just outside Forkill, and the IRA ambushed their patrol, and my dad was shot in the leg, survived, but his best friend and colleague, Willie John Hunter, was shot dead. So then after that happened, my parents then, their dad was moved by the police and he was stationed in Glengormley, and they moved to Glengormley, but came back to Fermanagh in the mid-60s.
And what happened then?
Well, I was born in 1969. I was born into a family that had, my father was a sergeant in the RUC, my mum was a sergeant in the Ulster Defence Regiment, and my older brother, who then went on to become a full-time member of the Ulster Defence Regiment as well.
So you were steeped in the security, if you like.
Yes, yes.
Plenty
of uniforms and hats in the house. And my early memories as about a 3-4-year-old would have been walking around the house with my dad's police cap on my head. And I wanted to join the RUC because I wanted to follow in the footsteps of my hero. My dad was my hero. Yeah. Unfortunately, his life was cut short at a later stage.
So, yes, bring me to that. Exactly what happened?
Remembering Sunday 1987, my dad and myself were going to the service at the Cenotaph, as we did every year.
What age were you then?
I had just turned 18 years of age. I was only young, just coming into, well, an adult really. I was just, I was still, if you want to other words put it, I was only a teenager. I had my whole life to look forward to, and hopefully I was going to join the RUC, but unfortunately due to what happened on the 8th of November 1987, I was unable to join the RUC. But that morning I always remembered, the day before, my dad had bought me a new leather jacket, and I wanted, like every teenager, I wanted to wear this fashionable jacket. And I do remember coming into the kitchen on our way to the service, and I had this leather jacket on. I was dressed in my suit trousers, shirt and tie, but I had this leather jacket on. And my mother gave me a funny look and says, "Where are you going?" And I says, "I'm going to the Cenotaph with Dad." And he says, "Not with that jacket, you're not." So I toed and froed for a few minutes, and Mum reneged, and I got to wear my jacket. But we left Mum to the Church of Ireland Cathedral in Enniskillen. She was doing usher. And my dad and myself walked. We parked the car down from the church, and we walked the short distance to the Cenotaph, and we had taken up our position just as we did every year at the front of the reading room wall. And there was people, Dad, myself wouldn't have seen, particularly Dad wouldn't have seen maybe in 12 months, probably from the last Remembrance Day service. And I remember an on-duty police officer walked past and spoke to my dad, and I turned to my dad and asked who was that, but I never got the answer. All I remember initially was a thud in the back and going forward. I never heard the explosion. There's other people who survived, like myself. They had said they've never heard anything like it, the noise, but I never heard the bang. I remember coming round, I was knocked unconscious, and I remember there was a blue railing that separated the road from the footpath, and I had been pushed up against the railing at my waist, but I tried to move, I couldn't move, and my initial first thought was, my dad, where is he? And I looked down to my right, and he was lying, semi-buried, and I recognised him because he was wearing his signature shiny shoes. Obviously, being in the police, he always dressed immaculately. His shoes were polished, that you can near enough see your face in them, and I knew by his shoes that that was him, because apart from that, he was unrecognisable. His head had actually, where I had went up on top of the railings, he had went down and into the railings. And the only way I can describe it really is the way you take a top of an egg. His head was gone just from above his left eye. So it was just as if you put a knife straight through and the top of his head was gone. But I knew his body was lifeless and I knew he was dead. I tried to move, but there was this eerie silence. And then all of a sudden, as if you flicked the switch, the noise just erupted. There was children screaming and crying. There was women crying, men screaming. And I say, I tried to move. I couldn't move. I was wedged down against the railings with the rubble. And it's just that eerie silence. And then all of a sudden, two soldiers came to me. They were part of the parade. And they were late coming. The parade hadn't really officially started. And next thing, there was just a mass of soldiers landed on the scene. And they were shouting orders. And they tried to pull me out. They pulled me out of the rubble. And all I wanted to do was get my dad. But they obviously knew. They didn't want me as an 18-year-old seeing what I seen to be part of that. They got me away from that area so then they could work in the rescue effort and get the rest of the bodies out.
Oh, and so what was the damage? I mean, how many, your father was killed?
Yes, he was killed. I survived.
And no after effects, no?
I've had long-term medical problems since that fateful day. At the time, I spoke about the leather jacket that my mum didn't want me to wear. When I was taken to the hospital, I had severe lacerations to the back of the head, which I needed 12 to 18 stitches, with shrapnel wounds in the back of the head. But the jacket was cut to ribbons, and the doctor had said that jacket saved me from severe, worse injuries. If not, it saved my life. Because the jacket was padded. So when the rubble and the slates were coming down off the building, the jacket, because it was padded, they actually saved my life. So that's why I always have a wee kind of, not a chuckle in a certain way, but it's kind of, my mum didn't want me to wear the jacket.
Yes.
But I dug my heels in and she allowed me to wear the jacket, and that jacket then actually saved my life.
Okay, so you were a victim then of that bomb and violence. What else was going on around you? You said there was an eerie silence and then that turned to screaming.
Yes, it was as if you flicked the switch. Obviously, I was coming out of consciousness when, I don't know, maybe it was, some people say that they see a dark light at the end of a tunnel. I can't say I've seen that because I hadn't the near-death experience. But the eerie silence makes me think maybe this was part of it, that maybe I shouldn't have survived, or I know I was very, very lucky to come out of that with my life, but it was the eerie silence that it's hard to explain. And I remember my mouth filled with dust and you couldn't even see your hand in front of your face. The dust, this was just, I'm talking literally within the first minute of the explosion, where the rubble and just, and some of the TV footage you can actually see where you can't even see the building with the dust.
Okay, so have you found out how big this bomb was? And
I've heard about it in the press that it wasn't initially as big as what we had originally thought. Obviously, then there was the Semtex boost to it, because I've seen aerial photographs in the years afterwards that the whole building was just decimated, and they claimed that it was only a 30-pound bomb, but they had the effects of maybe a 300-pound bomb, because the bomb that they found in Tullyhaman, which didn't go off, it was to coincide with Enniskillen, where the target was school children. It was 10 times the size of Enniskillen, so it doesn't bear thinking if that bomb had went off in Tullyhaman. I think it was a 300-pound bomb.
But that particular bomb, who was it meant for? And who was being targeted at that particular time?
The perpetrator, the terrorists themselves, claimed that the army had set the bomb off early, that it wasn't for civilians, it was to get the army that were on parade. But out of all the years that I remember that cenotaph service, the army formed up on the far side of the street. So the bomb was in the wrong place to start with. The position of that position where all the civilians stood, it was a sheltering point, because at the top of the town where the cenotaph is, because it's elevated, there's open areas down to the lock. There's always a wind comes up and people always shelter in front of that building. So for any years I remember, and I've checked back for since the duration of the memorial service in Enniskillen, the civilian people had no connection with the security forces or the military, always stood there. So it has been proven that the target was civilians.
I see.
I know the terrorists said that the target was the army, but then what was their target in Tullyhaman?
Yeah.
Where there's only going to be a policeman and a soldier laying a wreath, when you would have up to 100 school children. So they couldn't say that the target there was military or security forces, when clearly it was for young school children, boys' brigade, girl guides, cub scouts. So the target in Enniskillen was civilians.
Just memories of that day. You know, most people have a kind of a block out on that, but the... Tell me what happened directly afterwards. You know, the wake of your father.
The wake is probably the one and only part of that fateful day that I have great difficulty remembering. I remember exactly everything that happened on the day of the bombing and that evening. But the wake, the 2 days after, because Dad was killed on the Sunday, he was buried on the Tuesday. But one part of the wake I do remember is the house was full, with people coming to pay their respects, and the knock came to the door, and I went to the door, and there was a local businessman from Enniskillen had stood outside, and I had gestured to the man, "Would you like to come in?" And he said, "Stephen, I'll not come in. I'm ashamed to be a Catholic." And them words registered with me, and I can still see him and his face, and not name him, I can still see his face. And my reaction to that was, it wasn't Catholics who murdered the innocents in Enniskillen, they were terrorists.
Yeah.
So I say I had never any blame portioned against the Catholic community. The people who murdered my dad claimed to be Catholics, but they weren't Catholics, they were terrorists.
And who claimed responsibility for doing that?
It took a long time for anybody to claim responsibility. When they did claim, the IRA claimed responsibility, but their hierarchy said it was a rogue unit that didn't act on authority of Northern Command. That it was, I think it was southeast or south Fermanagh, south Donegal, and Cavan units of the IRA. There's actually three different units of the IRA were proven to have taken part. But the Sinn Féin had come out and says that they weren't acting on behalf of the IRA. I find that strange, hard to believe. Maybe if there was only one unit, you could understand, but there was three different units, our active service units, in their term, were participating, how they would act without the knowledge of Northern Command.
And where did you have to get counselling, or did you suffer post-traumatic stress, or was there anybody to give you treatment?
At the time, we didn't get any counselling. Because back then, during the height of the Troubles, there wasn't as many counsellors as there maybe is today. And because Enniskillen happened today, something happened the next day, and something happened the day after. It was like an ongoing effect. So they were short-staffed, and I can understand that they could not offer counselling. The first time I ever spoke to a counsellor about what happened to me was coming up to the 20th anniversary in 2007, that I went and got counselling in the OMA Trauma Centre, which was set up after the OMA bombing in 1998.
I see.
And that was the first time that I ever actually spoke to anybody. My wife Sharon, I never told her for 6 months of what happened. She knew my dad was dead, but she didn't know how he died. She initially thought because he had a heart attack, he left the place early.
Oh, you didn't want to tell her?
No. And if the conversation came up when I was at home, I wouldn't even speak to my own mother of what I experienced. And if the conversation had come up, I would leave the room and go into my bedroom. I just kind of, I become reclusive to a certain extent.
I see.
So I just physically couldn't talk about what I experienced.
How, you've told your story before and it's being published. And,
that's right,
and
that. Yes.
Does it help to do that?
Yes, I would say yes. I would say it's a form, with me telling my story now, it's my form of counselling. So every time I get the opportunity to tell my story of what happened, that gives me this inner feeling that I'm counselling myself or consoling myself in a certain extent, where I can actually speak about my story. Some people don't like speaking about what happened to them, and I can totally understand that, but I'm the opposite. I feel that the more opportunity I get, it does help me with the healing process.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that you do talk about it, do you think that the now that you know that you people know your story, that other people as well should do similar? Do you think that coming together and that the people who caused that trouble, would you meet them?
No.
Have you got any? Is there anything in you that says, you know, I forgive that person who did that?
Christian, I am a Christian, but Christians always find a way of forgiving people. I know there's other people like myself that have suffered at the hands of terrorists. They have forgiven people. That's their right. I personally couldn't forgive them. The reason being, they have never asked me for forgiveness. In fact, you know, how can I forgive somebody who doesn't want to be forgiven? So it's not for me to say I forgive the people that murdered my father and the other 11 innocent civilians. Until they come out and seek forgiveness and say that what they did was wrong, then maybe that could be a different way of looking at it. But this is now, we're actually only 6 weeks away from the 30th anniversary, and nobody has ever come out. Nobody has ever been arrested and convicted of that act of murder, and we will never get justice. Not in my lifetime. Maybe when they go to meet their maker, it could be a form of justice, but certainly we won't get justice. And people that carried out this act of murder and their political wing have always claimed that they were fighting a war. They've justified the murder of innocent civilians, innocent people. And until the day they stop justifying murder, then people like me cannot turn around and forgive them. You can't forgive somebody who doesn't seek forgiveness.
And when you see prisoners being released, does that upset you, or with the Good Friday Agreement when prisoners were released?
It certainly at the time, it caused great distress to our family, that perpetrators who were found and convicted of heinous acts of murder went to jail. Now, I'm talking about terrorists on both sides, whether it's Republican or Loyalists. If they were locked up for life, they should have stayed in jail for life. No deals should have been done to get peace by letting the people who caused murder and mayhem in this country for 30 years out of jail early. We have never been, I feel since the 8th of November 1987, I have been sentenced to a term of prison, because I've lost the right to have a father. I lost my mum 10 years ago this December to cancer, her cancer was brought on by the stress and strains of losing her husband at such an early age. So I have been sentenced to a lifetime form of imprisonment, so to speak, but with the chance of never getting parole, because I'll never get my father back, if that makes sense.
It does. Of course it does. Do you think, though, that is there an opportunity? I mean, do you see your Catholics living beside you or near you? Do you see them as a threat to you?
No, most definitely not. Growing up, I was brought up, as I said, in a security force family. And the risks back then were daily risk. No, every day my dad or mum went out, they wouldn't get into the car without checking it. But I was never brought up to turn against the Catholics. My best friends growing up, and I remember from primary school age, we always lived in a mixed area. Because dad and mum wanted to normalise, didn't want to segregate my brother. My brother was 7 years older, didn't want to segregate us from the Catholic religion or Catholic community. So we grew up, and I say my best friends growing up were Catholics. When I joined the local golf club in Enniskillen, my best friends were Catholics. And to this day, Catholics are my best friends. So it was never about religion. My wife is a Catholic. She was born in County Cork. So people can't say that, you know, well, me personally, I can't say that I don't have anything against, never had anything against the Catholic faith.
I see. Can I ask you, do you feel yourself as an Irishman?
I would always see myself as British. I have a British passport. My wife, on the other hand, she sees herself as Irish, and she carries an Irish passport. But down the line, there's who's to say I won't have an Irish passport. I probably will end up getting an Irish passport. But my fear is the way that, because of terrorism, it's put a different mindset on people distinguishing where they are actually, their nationality.
You mean putting them into boxes?
Boxes. Because the Republican terrorist, claimed to be Irish. But then I always claim to be British, and I always see allegiance to the crowd, to the UK as a British citizen, because I feel that Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom. So that means I am British. I can understand people about the same, could be my next door neighbour, could see it the other way, where they claim to be Irish. But my fear is, or my reasoning behind that is, the people who murdered my father claim to be Irish. So for me to claim to be Irish, I'm putting myself in the same box as the perpetrator, if that makes sense.
Yes, I can see where you're going with that. But it does tend people are worried. People go around with their heads down. They're afraid to say what they are, mm-hmm. and to do. And is that something that you feel that shouldn't be there? I mean, you're living a life of fear, mm-hmm. In that you can't speak out, or that you can't. But I'm not saying you personally now, because you've just told your whole story, but there are people who do generally go around with their heads down.
Some people find that when they're asked what nationality are, they're embarrassed. You've nothing to be embarrassed about. If somebody wants to claim to be Irish, I don't have a problem with that. But nobody can tell me. I has been told me in the past, sure, how are you British? You were born in Ireland. You know, that to me is an insult to me and what I believe. I don't turn around to them and say, even though they're born in the same street, I don't say, hold on here, you're born in the United Kingdom, you're not, you're British. It's whatever they want to do, but nobody has the right to tell anybody else where they define their nationality.
And the same would go for customs and tradition, your traditions, and that you'd respect their traditions.
Mm-hmm. But yes, that's most definitely, yeah. Yes, definitely. People, if somebody wants to go to an Orange Parade, mm-hmm. I don't have an issue with that. Or if somebody wants to go to the St. Patrick's Parade, which is, St. Patrick's, yes, I know, was supposed to be for everybody, but the way it's being portrayed, it turns the element to Irishness. I know St. Patrick is the patron saint of Ireland, yes, I understand that, but there's that triumphalism with tricolours being waved, particularly in a unionist person's face, from a neighbour type thing, which I don't agree with. The same way I wouldn't agree with an orange person waving their flag or their collarette or whatever in the face of a nationalist who might not necessarily agree with it, but off a different tradition. If somebody wants to celebrate their culture, let them do it. But don't make a mock of either or. Mm-hmm.
Just to revert back again to your childhood and growing up in the mm-hmm. house, and so living with your dad and your mum both in the security forces, could you describe what it was like?
I suppose I was born into that situation. No, I wasn't born earlier and kind of progressed into the troubled time. I was born in 1969 at the very start of the Troubles, as I say, into a security force family. But I learned to live with having parents in security forces. As I said before, if we were going out anywhere, we weren't allowed out of the house until either mum or dad checked the car. And particularly at night, if we were going out, dad always had to be very careful and mum of an ambush or whatever. But my first memory of something happening in our family was also in November 1974. I think it was the 4th of November. And after primary school, my granny lived just across the road from the school. And I'd always go down there after school, and either my mum or dad would pick me up on their way home from work. And I remember dad coming in full uniform and ushering my granny into the back room and closing the door. And I overheard the conversation of dad saying, "Gladys, who was my mum, has been in an explosion along the border. She's okay, she's in hospital." And I remember hiding under the kitchen table. Like, I was only 5 years of age at this stage. And what had happened, mum was driving the Army Land Rover down along the border. In fact, it's not far from, actually, it's only about 4 miles as the crow flies from my house. And they were hit by a massive landmine. Thankfully, everybody on the patrol survived, but she had spent about 3-4 days in hospital and had severe cuts and bruises to the face. So that's my initial first memory of anything that happened during the terrorist campaign that we suffered in this country. As I say, growing up, when I went to school, particularly when I got a wee bit older, the thought was, am I going to have a parent when I go home? Because at that time, an awful lot of people were being murdered, you know, particularly off our part-time members of the Ulster Defence Regiment, where they weren't out on duty in their second job. They might have been working in their farm, milking cows, and particularly along the border, where an awful lot of murder was happening. So my thought and memories then was thinking, you know, I could go home here and I could be one of these people to be told the devastating news that a parent has been murdered. And initially, when dad had retired early, after 28 and a half years, he was only 47 when he retired. He was 49 when he was murdered. I'm now actually 48 next month. So I'm only a year younger than what my dad was when he was murdered. And when dad retired, we became very close. Obviously, because he was a station sergeant, he would have been away early in the morning before I got up to go to school. And then he would have come in that evening, nighttime, when I was in bed. So I didn't really get to see much of my dad, only really on his days off. So when he retired, we became very close and we spent a lot of time together. And unfortunately, I only had 18 months of that quality time.
And they persisted, your parents, even though your mother there, she was involved in having that skirmish and to come out of that with all, you know, I suppose shell shocked is the word. And to want to continue to do her job.
That's right.
Why was there that determination to continue?
Mum found that she had to continue on because she was the only person bringing in money into the house. Say I was only 18 years of age. Now, Mum only worked for approximately another 5 years after that because she had to give up work because of the stress and what happened. It was slow to hit her, the realisation that her husband was murdered. So then she just got to a stage where she couldn't cope. And obviously with the threat of terrorism, she obviously had to give up her thought. If she gave up her job, it would bring some sort of normality to her life, thing. I do remember, I was probably about the first 12 months, as I said before, I wanted to join the RUC. But because of my condition or my injuries, I failed the medical, which was a devastating blow. As I say, I wanted to join the RUC to follow in the footsteps of my hero. So I then thought about joining the part-time UDR. And at that stage, my mum was the recruiting sergeant. So it was her that signed off the paperwork. But I remember doing the interview, the medical, I passed the medical, but never got word from headquarters that when to go for training. Now, bearing in mind, I was at the local technical college in town, and she obviously thought she didn't want her son joining the UDR after what happened to her husband.
Yeah.
And it was only probably 3 years before she died that she told me, but I kind of had an inkling anyway that this is what she did. She actually admitted for the first time that she blocked my application.
Did she?
But hindsight was the right thing to do.
Yes.
Because at that stage, said I was at the local college, and I would have been going, obviously, doing my duty at night, and that would have meant I was an easy target, obviously, because you don't carry a firearm or whatever, but she made the conscious decision that she didn't want me joining.
Wow. And you could have, yes, indeed, because I'm just thinking you grew up in the Troubles. You knew nothing else but the Troubles. So it became the norm then.
That's right.
The way of life.
I think the initial, what I initially thought when Dad was murdered was, it was not, there was never any inkling for either my brother or myself to seek revenge. I remember coming the day of the bombing from the hospital, and my brother was driving the car, and we were coming down the wee short hill from the old Erin Hospital. And my mum said to my brother, stop. And she turned round and she said to my brother, myself, I said, my brother was 7 years older and he was in the Ulster Defence Regiment that time. And she says, I don't want you pair of boys getting involved with any retaliation.
Okay.
We don't want to put any innocent Catholic through what we're about to go through.
And did that resonate? Did you really feel then that you...
Yes, most definitely. Them words, I say, I'll never forget them words. I can still, if I close my eyes, I can actually still go back through exactly what was said. Now, I'd be a liar to say that part of me wanted to take revenge.
Okay.
But then every time I thought of it, this was in the early months, within the first year of that act of murder, I'd always think back to what my mum said.
Yeah.
And the thought too that my best friends were Catholics. Like, I couldn't go out and take some innocent person's life. Now, the reason why I came to that was, I wanted to join the security forces. It wasn't to seek revenge. It was to actually protect other innocent people from terrorism.
All right. So I got to ask you a final question then. Define what exactly an RUC officer does. What's his brief? Her brief?
I said before, my dad served in the Royal Ulster Constabulary, which was the police force here in Northern Ireland. My understanding of the work of the RUC was just like any other police force. If it's in Surrey in England, if it's in Yorkshire, it was the police force for that jurisdiction, which was Northern Ireland. Similar to what the Guards did south of the border, the RUC did north of the border. And I wouldn't be too familiar with the history of the RUC, but what I do know is, from things my dad would have told me over the years, that the RUC came about from the Royal Irish Constabulary, which was the police force of the 32 counties of Ireland. And then obviously then, with the split between the south of Ireland, or the Irish Republic, and Northern Ireland, the RUC came into force in the north.
Okay.
So my understanding is the RUC would have been originated from the Royal Irish Constabulary. They would have been similar to what, as I said, the police would have done in the south. The only problem here in the north, in Northern Ireland, was that the threat of terrorism, and obviously that's why the RUC men carried weapons to protect themselves and the communities against acts of terrorism. So they would have had to do their daily jobs now under duress at times, because in certain areas like South Armagh, they couldn't actually fulfil of giving out summonses, doing, say, road traffic accidents and things like that. So they would have had to do the normality of the police work, which, as I say, was summonses and road traffic accidents and keeping the peace. When I say keeping the peace, I don't mean against terrorism, but I mean if fights broke out in bars or things like that. And then obviously then their main, over the years of through terrorism, would have been to fight the terrorist. And I mean, what I mean by fight, I don't mean hand-to-hand combat. I mean protecting the locals and trying to rid out terrorism.
So the
stop acts of terrorism happening.
The difference between a soldier and an RUC person.
If my understanding, the difference between a soldier, say a member of the British Army that would have served in Northern Ireland, and a member of, like my dad in the RUC would have been looking after the civilian people, whereas the Army would have come in to keep peace, to stop, obviously, they go in, what's the way I'm looking at it, because they come in to protect the RUC and protect the innocents from the onslaught of acts of terrorism being carried out by terrorists. And when I say terrorists, I mean, I talk about terrorists on both sides, both so-called loyalist terrorists and Republican terrorists.
Okay, very good. I just, it was interesting to hear, because the situation is so different up here in the north, and the work that they have to do and did do.
It was just that factor, because I remember Dad saying about if they had, particularly along in the border areas, where I think back in the olden day, the police would have went and checked for the cattle, for illegal cattle that were smuggled in. And then obviously that was made that much harder because two policemen couldn't drive into a border area. But back then they had to be flown in by helicopter with the backup of the army.
I see.
It's just that it was just unsafe.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, thank you.
No, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. I appreciated you telling your story.
You're very welcome.